Hello and welcome to this very special edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I am Chapin Hemingway, joined as always by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk, baby. Here we are, guys, back at it again. It's peak fixy season. I think we may have watched the first movie that could actually be up for an Oscar Best Picture. I could be wrong. I hope Mank is, but this week we're going to be looking at Netflix's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, starring the late Chadwick Boseman, and as well as Viola Davis, and directed or produced by one of my favorite actors, Denzel Washington. So we're going to talk about that movie, and then we're going to get into a, we're also going to talk about another movie that came out recently on Christmas, Wonder Woman 1984, which both Lee and I watched, and Jeremy did not. Sexist. So we're going to explain, we're going to see if he can guess the plot of Wonder Woman 1984. And then once he does, since it's not going to be very hard, we're going to talk about a little bit about the movie. Okay, guys. Lee, I know you're a bit of a Philistine and aren't as familiar with the theatrical world as Jeremy and I. Theater being plays. So I hope you can keep up to this conversation.
Where is this coming from?
But
is it because Jeremy married a thespian?
Yes. And he directed The Pillow Man.
What that meant.
Guys, so Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was originally a play by August Wilson.
August Wilson.
His second play.
Yep. After Fences.
Fence. And no, Fences came later.
Of course. Yep. I know.
So, Lee, can I get through this intro without you interrupting? And to me, I just have to say, I think this felt very much like a play adaptation. Not to get into that's not a good or bad thing. That's not a. I think you could tell. And I wanted to ask you guys. I feel like we've reviewed another film on this podcast. I can't think of it right now that was based on a play. But I'm wondering what you guys think of plays as material for film adaptations. How do you think they play out? No pun intended. Is the idea? I mean, for me, I think mostly a play is dialogue, and so these are pretty dialogue heavy movies generally. But how do you guys feel like plays are adapted in Hollywood? Do you think they're usually pretty good, or where do you fall? Anybody want to start?
Yeah, I'll start, because it was one thing I wanted to bring up with this, because it was hard to ever forget that this was a play when you're watching it. Like, it bothers me a little bit, and I think it's a nitpicky thing, but when I can't ever forget that I'm watching a play because the movie's not doing something cinematically unique to bring that play to another level, I just can't get it out of my head for some reason. It takes me a little bit out of the film experience. And it's interesting you talk about that because of, you know, the times we live in, you know, like Hamilton was released on Disney and I loved watching that, which is
so cool,
which is a play that's basically been recorded. It's the actual play that's been recorded. And there was also like a Streetcar Named Desire that we watched, which is again a play that had been recorded.
But even that Hamilton recording was done three times, and one of the times they shot it with a Steadicam, so you got a view of the play that you didn't get
Watch it. But it's still different than what they're trying to do with this film. This is a film where you can cut between characters. You can move to any side of the room. You can be more filmic with it. Like the opening shot is downtown New York, early, 1920s, this amazing shot.
Chicago, yeah.
Or Chicago. So there's things you can do with a film that you can't do with a play. And I would like to see movies try to or plays that turn into movies, try to exploit that a little bit more and take me out of the fact that I just know I'm watching a play and would almost rather watch it as a play than watch it as a movie. And that's not to say I had issues with this, but that's just kind of like, as an audience member, that's how I felt. I'm like, I think I would have really enjoyed this more as a theatrical experience.
Yeah, I think we clearly all had the same initial reaction to this, because it was one of the first few things that I wrote down, was just the obviousness of this as a play. And you watch a movie like this, and you can see the director, George C. Wolfe, you know, trying to change his camera angle here, move the camera a little bit there, but it's all very staged. He's usually in one location for a long period of time. The whole movie takes place really in maybe like three different locations, with the exception of the, you know, opening scenes, the cutaway scenes to the streets. And for me, I'm sort of the opposite, Jeremy. Like, once I get used to it, then I'm in it and I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, no, I
would rather have
eventually.
I would rather have like a Few Good Men experience, where also based on a play, but totally cinematic. Like,
I didn't even know
it's
that was
everywhere. That there's, you know, there's scenes in apartments, in courtrooms, in you know, in Cuba or wherever they film that. But it's all over the place. It's very much a movie.
I wonder if that had something to do with the playwright actually being able to adapt his own work.
His own work, Aaron Sorkin. That's possible. And this is not. That's not the case here. That was not the case with Fences, which Denzel Washington directed, I think, 2 years ago, also based on the August Wilson play. And a bunch of others came to mind. Did you guys ever see Carnage? I think it was called Carnage. Roman Polanski, I think, directed it with Kate Winslet, and Christoph Waltz is in it, and I forget, there's two other actors in it. It's just basically like two couples in an apartment arguing over a fight their kids got in the whole time, and it's a play. It's just a play filmed, basically. The opening has a shot outside, and the end has a shot outside. Everything else is just in that room. And this felt similar, and what I do often find, at least the ones that I see, these types of plays take with them is a solid screenplay that is driven by dialogue, and it's often usually pretty quick and pretty witty, and it's in place to keep your attention because there's no fancy camera work. There's not a lot of other things and other tools that are being used. So the screenplay is all they have to hook the audience. And I think this movie, like others like it, did a good job with that.
Yeah, I think that's interesting you brought it up, because it just makes me think, like, the way that this movie has to turn for its characters and have its characters feel some sort of change is through dialogue with other characters, or internalization instead of an external thing happening to them from the outside world, because they can't ever leave these rooms. So instead of, you know, an avalanche that's going to be coming down the street, it has to be, you know, it has to be something pretty serious in a conversation that gets these characters.
Yeah, one character
going to
brings
details.
Something up that triggers something in another character. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with what both you guys said. I think I never forgot that this was a play and that I felt like I was watching a play, but I really liked the way they filmed this. I think it's beautifully shot. Like you were saying, Jeremy, the some of the outdoor stuff, like the hot summer of Chicago, but also even the internal stuff I thought was really nice. And I think, you know, in trying to find a way to make these scenes more exciting from a filmic point of view, I think the George C. Wolfe, or whatever his name is, the director, did a great job with that, because he like moved his, like, you know, when you have these like long like slew of dialogue, I think you can have like these longer shots. And I thought there's a really interesting one where I think it's Ma enters the recording studio for the first time, and they like track with her, and then they track back to somebody else talking, and then they pick her up again on the other side. So you get a real nice sense of the space. It's kind of a beautiful brick building. You've got the room where the band is sort of rehearsing and talking ahead of time, and that's another sort of atmospheric location. And I thought they did a great job. I'm with you too. I'm with you though, Jeremy, because like at the end of this, when the climax of the movie happens, I still felt like I was in a play, and I kind of wished I had seen a play. Not that I didn't enjoy the movie one way or the other, but I was like, oh yeah, this would be kind of great to see like on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Where interestingly enough, Charles S. Dutton played the role the Chadwick Boseman role twice, once 20 years apart. So a little interested in how he was able to do that. But
I agree. Like, and you know, that was the question you asked us, so that's how I, you know, that's how I felt about it. But it doesn't mean that I dislike this movie or I had issues with any of the filmic aspects. I thought he did a good job. He did what he could with it. Like, what else are you really going to do? I mean, they opened up in, like, maybe it was Deep South or something on a concert that obviously wasn't part of the original play. Like, they tried to sort of give it a world that we could see through the lens, and I think they did a good job of that. But at the same time, because of its subject matter, and the, like I said, the way the characters have to reach some sort of emotional resonance, it has to be sort of standing in a room.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're making it much bigger. You're inserting flashbacks to see Chadwick Boseman, the things that he talks about in his monologue. We're seeing those actions take place. And this movie goes much bigger, and that wouldn't have worked. It would have been a worse movie if that were the case.
I'm glad they didn't do that, for sure.
Yeah, me too. I think the containment of it and the simplicity of it is what makes this work, and you need good acting to pull that off. You need good writing to pull that off. And again, like I said, he does, I think, just enough with his camera that you don't get bored. I mean, there's times where it's necessary to just hold the camera still, and there's times where you need to, you know, maybe do a weird angle or something just to keep things fresh, because you're ultimately just in a room with four walls and four characters talking to each other. Maybe you just need to, you know, twist things upside down a little bit just to keep your audience engaged. And, you know, I think that stuff works, and he does it enough.
It reminded me, did you guys ever see the Glengarry Glen Ross adaptation?
Yeah.
Like the movie?
Baldwin and Kevin
Yeah,
Spacey,
well, it's a play first.
Well, yeah. Right, yeah. I know. So, but the really famous one?
The really famous, you know, adaptation with all those guys in it. But yeah. It wasn't, you know, it didn't do very well when it first came out. I mean, this movie reminded me a lot of that, because I think it's a lot of these, like, mm-hmm. at least Glengarry Glen Ross is a lot of heavyweight actors, you know, doing this kind of really scene-chewing material. Sure. And I think there was a lot of that, too. You know, it was a little bit, you know, certainly with Chadwick Boseman's character, Levy. Before we get into the meat of the movie, would you guys ever be interested in adapting a play for a movie? Jeremy, I know you've directed a play. I've directed a couple of plays. Lee, you've directed a movie. So what would you guys think about finding a play and adapting?
I would love it. I mean, just because the structure of plays is usually something I'm really into, because they have to. I think playwrights are just better at structure than screenwriters in general. I think
they don't really have the luxury of a camera.
Like, exactly.
They have to show your attention on stage. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I always like these movies that are adapted from plays because of the screenplays. Like, they're well structured, with which both Jeremy and I are often drawn to. And I think a lot of times you have really good, interesting dialogue. And, like, you know, we talk a lot about this, like all, you know, film people do, that, you know, movies are supposed to show and not tell. A lot of times these types of movies that are based on plays do a lot of telling, right? Because there's just a lot of dialogue, and a lot of things is expository, but there are creative ways to work around that, and there's metaphor.
Yeah,
and
talking isn't necessarily telling. Dialogue's
exactly,
not necessarily telling.
There's metaphor, and there's different ways to do things, and I always love those kind of creative aspects of these types of movies, and I think that's a challenge for the screenwriter and the director and the actors, and so it's definitely a cool challenge.
All right, guys, what'd you think? The movie.
I really liked it. I did. I really liked it. And I want to be the first person on the podcast to say, like, I wanted to come on this podcast because I think I'm just like a terrible person. And I wanted to say, like, yeah, Chadwick Boseman was good, but I think he's getting a lot of the hype because he had passed away recently and it's probably not warranted. He's amazing in this. That character seems nearly impossible to play realistically and have sort of an emotional connection to and believe most of everything he goes through. He does an amazing job. And same with Viola Davis. I think she's just perfect as Ma Rainey. So those are my two major two cents.
I was surprised that she certainly doesn't have the emotional arc that he has. But I thought she was really good. I also like Chadwick Boseman a lot. I don't know that it doesn't sound like I liked him as much as you did, Jeremy, but I thought he was great. I mean, this is obviously the meaty role, at least from the male side. and is he the star, do you guys think? I mean, obviously Ma Rainey is the...
I was going to ask you guys about that. Like, where do these people fall in the actress, actor, supporting categories?
I would say they're both...
I think Boseman is a lead more than Viola Davis is, but...
Yeah, it's a good question.
I would say they're both leads.
I'll echo both your sentiments here. I mean, in particular with those two performances, I loved Viola Davis. Loved her so much more in this than in Widows, which I thought she overacted in. And this was almost more ripe for overacting at times, and I thought she pulled it off really nicely. Jeremy, similar to the things that you said about Chadwick Boseman, I mean, I felt, and I know I mentioned this to you, Chapin, that I admire Chadwick Boseman. I respect him for the roles that he chose. I think he played important roles. He portrayed important historical people, Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall, and then mostly he was the Black Panther, which represents a superhero for... You know, black children growing up. I think it's very important, but none of that.
I feel very badly. I haven't seen any of those real life representations.
I saw Jackie Robinson. I mean, it's a Disney sports movie. You've seen it if you've seen any of the other ones. But
okay,
Angels in the Outfield.
Exactly. I never saw Marshall. But I you know, none of those things to me meant he was a good actor. I had failed to kind of see the great actor that everybody was, you know, proclaiming him as after he died. And that sounds, I don't want to sound bad, but maybe what he did in this role was what I was missing. Maybe this was in other roles that I haven't seen, or maybe this was just the best he's ever been, because he was amazing in this movie. I loved his performance. Like you said, Jeremy, it's a hard role to pull off, the emotional range, the scene chewing nature of it. And he did it all so well. That monologue I thought was heartbreaking and intense and just an absolutely stunning performance. What I really loved about this movie, though, was the dichotomy between all these character groups, and in particular, Ma Rainey, Viola Davis. You know, she has status, she's powerful, but it's really just because she makes the white men money. And she probably realizes that, but she's going to milk it for everything that she can, and she's going to take advantage of it as long as she has that power and status. Whereas Levy looks at Ma Rainey and he wants the power and status that she has, but doesn't quite realize what it is. Like, he thinks it's talent-based. He has talent. He can get that. And he's striving for that. He's going to do whatever he can. He's going to push everybody aside to get to that point because he feels like he deserves it. And then you kind of have the rest of the band, these older guys who are just like, they know the way of the world and they know their place in it and are sort of resigned to it. And it's sad in its own way. And I just thought, watching those kind of three perspectives play out through all this dialogue and through these scenes, and then, you know, them interacting with the two guys at the studio, the two white men at the studio, their manager and the producer. I thought that worked so well and was just like such a really good way to kind of show what black people went through during this time period and probably to a certain extent still do. And to basically portray that in a way where you're watching your main characters not necessarily see eye to eye on how they're treated and why, but they are all ultimately treated the same way, was really smart.
Did you guys get a sense of what Ma Rainey's beef was? Like, she was just immediately came in and was, the first time you lay eyes on her, she's mad about something.
I think she knows she has to be. Like, she has to be emphatic or she won't get what she needs because she's a black woman.
Yeah, it's her only credit in the world, is her only currency is basically to own the stardom she has because of her voice, and her voice is what makes the money. And she says it in the movie that she knows without it that she's nothing to them, but she's seen some shit. It's all over her face that she's lived the life and she got to this point and she's not losing it right now for anybody. And she's not putting up with anything for anybody. And it's
and that
Viola
creates an
Davis.
Amazing clash between her and Levy, which I love.
Amazing.
Like, so there's because they're ultimately dealing with the same thing.
There's that scene after the concert performance where she walks through what looks like, you know, this is 1920 something, where she's walking through what looks like an all black hotel room or hotel, and like they're all looking at her weird, and not sure I quite understood that. What was your guys' interpretation?
Yeah,
that
one
scene?
Was a little ambiguous. I didn't know if it later on. I sort of thought it was because of her relationship with because
she's gay.
The younger woman there.
Yeah.
So I thought that's sort of what I assumed at the end of it, but yeah, that was a little bit ambiguous as to what that was.
Either that, or like you could understand the perspective that she's a bit of a sellout. You know, she basically is making a record for money with a white producer, and I mean,
do they all know that?
I are we supposed to believe it's the first time she's made the record? Like, the producer knows who she is. I mean, maybe it's the first time. I don't know. I agree. It's not entirely clear. I just think so much of what the character's motivations are in this movie are all ultimately based on the same thing. And it is just how black people are treated. And they all just come at it from a different direction. And that's what I liked. I thought that...
And also how they have to navigate the world.
Exactly. And based on their position in life. And...
Right.
You know, you take away Ma Rainey's voice, and to a smaller extent, much smaller extent, Levy's talents with the horn, like, they're all in the same place. Like, it's just one little thing here or there has gotten them a level of status that's given them a little more power and leeway, but they're fighting the same battles. And, I think that's what, like, the characters like Toledo and Slow Dragon Cutler are trying to explain to Levy a lot of the time. That he just doesn't want to listen to. He believes his talent can get him places where they're just trying to say, like, look, we have to all be in this together because everybody's against us.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And it's also interesting to see how, like, Irvin and the other guy ultimately take advantage of Levy and mm-hmm. Ma. And it's in sort of similar ways, in how they react, how they both react to it, and they react to it differently. And it's really interesting to talk about Levy's reaction to how he got taken advantage of, because it wasn't to then go after the white man ultimately. He right. internalized it around the white
and
man.
And you just saw it building up and building and building.
And took it out on... one of the other guys, and that's a scene I certainly want to talk about because I think it's the one scene that really, really doesn't work, but we can get into this.
Interesting. How did they take advantage of Ma, though?
Just the way that they were talking about, like, the fact that she knew as soon as she signed that paper, as soon as she put her voice on that recorder, that they were going to make the money.
Right, because they paid her a flat fee, like $250 or
exactly.
something.
They paid her the cash and paid everyone else what they got. And as soon as she signed away those rights, that part was over for
her. Well, and you have that scene where, is it her son that has the stutter?
It's her nephew.
Her nephew, right. That scene where she insists that he introduces her and it takes a number of different takes because he's a stutterer and he can't say it, and then it turns out that it never got recorded. Like, I think that's sort of just an example of the way that plays out is kind of a microcosm of what we're talking about, right? Like, she is insisting that she gets what she wants, but she didn't. Oh well, move on. Like, sorry. And I think that's a lot of what this is. Like, she only can her status and power can only go so far. It can only go so far as collecting that $250 paycheck.
He got paid at the end of the day.
I know, but it only goes so far as her signing that paper and them going off and making money and ultimately getting what they want. Like, she's just a pawn in their bigger scheme, essentially.
Aren't we all?
Okay, yeah. So Jeremy, Chadwick Boseman's character, Levy, has been talking about his own music that he's run by the producer who owns the studio they're recording in, presumably the record company, and the second to last scene of the movie is him saying, "Well, when are we going to record these?" He's given him the sheet music, given the producer the sheet music with all the lyrics and the music, yeah. And then.
And he pays him off. He gives him $5 a song and says,
gives him $5 a song, which is a very
puts it in his pocket.
Very famous, you know, infamously many white producers did this and built careers for white musicians off of the songs of black musicians. It's obviously a very well known trick. All the band members are getting ready to leave, and Toledo accidentally steps on Levy's shoes, and he gets all pissed and kind of...
Everything boils over.
Basically. Everything boils over, and he eventually stabs Toledo in the back and kills him.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just... It goes back to our initial conversation of... It reminded me that we were in a play. Because everything had to... crescendo at that point and in that room... And I just didn't. I didn't buy it. I didn't buy it earlier when he pulled the knife, and then the very next scene they were all recording and having a happy old jolly time. Even though Boseman played it well, and I think he played it as well as could possibly be, and it goes back to that monologue, because if that monologue didn't work, none of this payoff would work at all. But I think it was too much for the scope and the size of the movie that they were showing. And again, this is a movie. This isn't a play. It's written as a play, but it was shown to us as a film. And I think that it just didn't come across in this medium that well. And I think it might have worked on stage.
I mean, I agree that it's far-fetched. I bought it, though, mostly because I saw the buildup. I saw it coming. I mean, I knew it was going to happen.
I saw it coming, too.
You could just see Levy boiling over. And, you know, I do think it just, like, the size of it, I think that was well put. Like, the size of it felt out of place. Mm. It felt too big for the moment. You know, if maybe George C. Wolfe takes some creative freedom there and that... boiling over manifests itself some other way, but ultimately I bought it. I thought it worked, you know, like wasn't my favorite part of the movie, but I thought it was fitting too. I just think that it was, this entire movie is very metaphorical in a way. Like it's, you know, those actions that they're taking on each other, the conversations they're having with each other are representative of a much bigger picture. And I think that is attempting to do the same thing.
Yeah, of course. And after the moment passed, like they didn't, they just sort of stayed on Levy and Toledo dying. And I could feel myself being transported to the audience in an auditorium when that was happening. And that moment of sort of silence and you feel the people around you
and like the lights, the echo of the yell right before it happens.
Then you just sit in it, and the other actors have to have the shocked look on their face and wait, and that sort of the way the rhythm of it was. It was very theatrical, but in real life, not in real life, but in film, which is portraying sort of real life, the beat of that would have gone differently. It would have been sort of stab, and then the other people in that room reacting to that stab, maybe coming in and trying to help. But instead it was that, you know, let the light
freeze. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's just a constant reminder that I'm supposed to be watching this in a different format, but also it felt, again, too big for the moment, too big for what we had just seen.
But the movie doesn't ever try to take us away from that format. So
No,
it stays
again,
consistent.
I agree.
Yes. I think I agree with you, Jeremy. I was like, can someone die from being stabbed once? I don't know.
Is and can the other guys help him do
yeah.
something?
Yeah. Can we like what's going on here? Yeah. But no, they did feel like a theatrical experience. I actually didn't mind it. You know, like I think, I like being reminded of that theatrical. It reminded me of, you know, when you used to rehearse plays back in the day. I like being reminded of that, but it didn't feel real. I'll say that. Like it felt like this is an adaptation of a play, but it was an enjoyable feeling for me.
Yeah. And the reason like I'm saying it the way I am is because like the screenplay or the play, however you want to put it, is just phenomenal. It's unbelievably good writing. It's great structure. It's great acting. I think it is shot pretty well. Or even really well for what it is.
They're great showcases for actors because it's a lot of dialogue, it's a lot of performance, and then unlike a play, you really just get up close and personal with them. And I think that's like a different, it's definitely a different muscle, you know, like, you know, when you're on stage, you're hopefully projecting to the people in the back row and getting your performance there as well. But when the camera is 2 feet away from your face, it's a different thing. But then you still have all that great August Wilson dialogue and everything else that goes along with it too. So I found it very interesting. I think this is a great movie. I'm hoping we will talk more about it when we get into the fixies.
I'm sure we will.
Do you guys think this is going to be a play at the Oscars?
Well, Bozeman will. He'll win. They've decided.
Be interesting. I mean, some people were saying this is, or maybe no, maybe it was Nomadland that was the front runner for. I don't know. It's hard to tell, but.
Well, and One Night in Miami is another one based on a play. Regina King directed it. That's supposed to be a big player. Was Viola? I'm trying to look right. Was Viola Davis in Doubt also?
Yes.
Yes.
So this She's is at least her third adaptation of a play because she was in Fences too. Right. And maybe there's more that I'm not remembering, but that's interesting that she is drawn to these roles. I think Viola Davis has some play here in the Oscars, but I Chadwick Boseman won the Oscar already. Like, they decided before anybody saw the movie that he was going to win for this.
But best actor or best supporting?
They'll put him in supporting, and probably I don't know why, but yeah, that's what silly, I've been hearing.
And he should win it though. That's my whole point.
I think he's
like,
great.
He absolutely deserves to win it.
I want him to win because he's great in this, though. And the fact that it was already decided before anybody saw it suggests ulterior
motives.
Well,
it's like the Heath Ledger thing. It's like everyone wanted him to win.
Yeah, but everybody saw the movie before he died, so.
This world is not yet ready for all that you will do. The time will come, Diana. And everything will be different.
Citizens of the world,
I'm here to change your life.
Anything you want, anything you dream of, you can have it.
You look like you saw a ghost.
We've been talking here on the Get Your Film Fix podcast about the Warner Brothers move to release their 17 films slated for 2021 on HBO Max. And the first of those was Wonder Woman, 1984, the sequel to 2017's Wonder Woman, starring Gal Gadot, directed by Sally Jenkins?
Patty Jenkins.
So Lee and I saw it and we have our thoughts on it, and I want to get to those because I think this is a fun and interesting movie to talk about, but as a little experiment / game / fun little thing, we're going to try to explain, see if Jeremy can guess the plot. And so what kind of details did you want to give Jeremy, Lee?
I mean, we can give him the kind of lead actors, I think, and tell him when it's based. Jeremy, did you see the original Wonder Woman?
No. I know it's based in 1984. I don't know how she got there.
Okay, so she can't die. because she's from another, I don't know what they call it, same type of Wakanda type thing. Gal Gadot plays Diana Prince. She is Wonder Woman. Chris Pine, who died in the initial movie.
Love interest. Wanted to go back to see him.
But he comes back. That's important.
He's in the movie. Kristen Wiig plays someone named Barbara Minerva, who works at the Smithsonian. And then she also has the pseudonym of the Cheetah. Cheetah. And then you have Pedro Pascal, who we know from Game of Thrones, Narcos, evidently The Mandalorian. He plays Maxwell Lord, who's a Trumpian businessman that's kind of down on his luck but doesn't quite want to admit it. Mm-hmm. Takes place in 1984, and there's something that's called the... What do they call it? The Infinity Stone.
It's the right, so
Thanos.
It's
the passion fruit. I don't know what the hell do they call it.
It's the it's the Dream Stone or something.
The Dream
like
Stone. Okay, so there you go, Jeremy.
Really? Why do they all have to revolve around stones?
Okay.
So Jeremy, what do you think the Dream Stone does?
If you dream something, then you get what it does. Like
it,
you,
that's
you,
close you, enough. If you, you wish, if you wish it, you wish yeah, it, if you
it's
wish
like
it, it comes
Tinkerbell.
True.
Are there consequences to that?
Yeah, so what would happen
obviously
if...
Obviously, there's consequences to it, because, what's his name? Pedro Pascal, that is his name?
Yep.
He gets trying to get a hold of the Dream Stone. Mm-hmm. We obviously don't want him to, because he's going to, you know, do bad things with it, try to, you know, make himself wealthy.
Correct.
That's it. Despite what it does to the Earth.
How do you? That's exactly it. How do you think Steve Trevor?
Yeah, Chris Pine,
who died in 1917.
In the first one,
he was the pilot that crashed into those guys in 1917.
Oh, did he discover the Dream Stone initially?
No.
And no. All right. Was he a love interest of hers that she wanted back?
Oh, yeah.
And she had to go. Use the Dream Stone to get him back.
Yep, on it.
And then it you know, obviously couldn't last by the end of it, because she wanted something that she couldn't have. So well, somehow he
good.
Ended up, but he ends up saving the world by dying.
Man, you're really no on
one,
to this. Like,
no
so
one
what
dies
if I tell
movie.
You? What if I tell you that the Dream Stone gives you what you wish for, but it takes something valuable away?
Gotcha. Okay. So he came back because she wished him on the Dream Stone. And then it took, what did it take away? Her lasso or her powers or
yeah.
something that she needs to save the world. Is that true?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. All right. So I think I did pretty good.
Yeah.
That's
good.
Great.
What did Kristen Wiig do with this as a cheetah? That I can't quite
That's unclear.
Unclear.
That's still unclear.
Still
okay.
unclear.
The first part of it is that she wishes to be like Diana Prince and gets the Wonder Woman powers. But then there's some other little expository scene that I must have blinked during, and she becomes a cheetah. Unclear. Having said that, I liked Kristen Wiig in this movie, which is apparently an unpopular opinion.
I like her too, but I also like Chris Pine, which I know you don't agree with.
I thought he was so bad in this. This
well,
yeah,
I'll admit that he is like somebody from the 20s acting like Chris Pine.
No,
so
here's
that's...
what I'm going to say. This is so what this movie made me appreciate is the work that actors have to do. Actors get a script, they get signed on to a role, that whether they're method actors or not, they prepare for the role in some way, shape, or form. So that when they get on the set, you know, they've asked the unwritten questions. They know the details of their character. Chris Pine looked like he didn't know he was supposed to be in a movie. He was on the lot, and they're like, they grabbed him, and they just said, hey, we're shooting this. And he just tried to act in it. And that's what it looked like. And it was nearly unwatchable.
I disagree, but this was a very, very bad movie, in my opinion. I think it was much worse than the first Wonder Woman. I was very disappointed because just to sort of kick us off, I came into this thinking, okay, I'm Patty Jenkins. I was sort of this middling, I had this big debut with Monster. indie movie, won an Oscar, got a lot of attention, and then I was didn't do anything for like 20 years basically. Came back, had this huge success at this movie, and now I'm empowered. I can do something great. And they just made this shitty fucking movie.
It's so silly. I think they were going for that in a lot of ways. It's like this campy 80s movie, but that was not consistent. It didn't stick with it. It tried to have like actors acting like they were in like an 80s sitcom at times. And obviously the costumes were one piece, but that wasn't even it. It was just this like campy element that she tried to add that wasn't there all the time. And then there were just like these moments where like they're flying in an invisible jet and it's, also, it's the 4th of July, and also, there's fireworks, and also, let's just spend 5 minutes with these two in the plane with nothing happening but watching fireworks, and it just had nothing to do with the movie. So, it was just incoherent and, like, stagnant. Everything was, like, this scene, then this scene, then this scene, just to be there. And then on top of that, I thought the visual effects were really bad. For a $200 million movie, a lot of things looked really fake.
I agree. I
have a question for you guys. And I think I remember this from the first Wonder Woman. People really put a lot of pressure on it as a female-driven action movie people put a lot of pressure on themselves not to criticize it because of that. Did you feel like this movie put a lot of pressure on itself to live up to that?
I think a little bit. The first movie makes big waves in that department. I don't think this movie like took whatever banner it held on the first movie and ran with it. It's sort of like, well, okay, now it's time for us to make a more conventional comic book movie. And the weird thing is that this 1984 setting and the Pedro Pascal character in particular, Jeremy, he's this like Donald Trump-esque kind of like TV evangelist, but his whole thing is like he has a company that you can essentially like buy shares in that he advertises on TV that is like an oil company that isn't producing.
Yeah, he's up dry. Yeah.
It's like essentially you're like, he's like, he wants you to like buy shares of his company that is digging for oil. And I'm sort of intrigued by, you know, building your $200 million, like, you know, most important character in the Warner Brothers stable at the moment around this sort of, I'm intrigued by that, building it around this character who's, you know, this kind of ridiculous blonde weirdo. But honestly, like what Patty Jenkins does with it is just it's boring and off-putting and not at all fun and not really comic booky either. It's like it's not like high art and it's not comic book. It feels like they kind of landed in the middle here.
Yeah,
and so
totally.
It's incredibly uninteresting. And you know, they've got this sort of, I think Patty Jenkins was talking about it in her press tour about like not wanting anybody to die. And you know,
wanting to resolve it with dialogue.
With dialogue, yeah, okay. I mean, that's admirable, I guess. But like, this movie is not the movie to do it with. You know, like this is, we've just watched 2 hours because this movie is 2 hours and 30 minutes long, 2.5 hours of
and the last
bullshit.
Half hour is that and monologue.
Yeah, exactly. Is her monologuing about why, you know, truth is better than what you think you want or some bullshit.
Yeah. There's a moment in this movie that I realized. So Gal Gadot has, Wonder Woman has just been pining for
Chris Pine.
For 60 years for Chris Pine. You know, we get the impression that she's never loved again. You know, she's sort of a museum nerd working at the Smithsonian. And anyway, he comes back. She wishes for him to come back, and the consequence of that is she's losing her power. And she's starting to come to that realization. He's coming to that realization. They realize what they have to do. And then I was realizing, I was like, okay, you could look at this movie one of two ways. I mean, Wonder Woman is supposed to be, like, very empowering for women. You know, Gal Gadot, I think, ultimately, is a pretty good leading lady. And Patty Jenkins is a good director, whether this movie is evidence of that or not. But I was starting to realize this is doing one or two things. You can look at this two ways. You could either look at it in that idea that men are holding women back, right? Like, she has her man now, but it's taking her power away. So get rid of the man, she'll have her power back, and women can be stronger, right? That works. That's a message. Or it's that even powerful women just sit around moping, waiting for their man to come back in their life. So I'm like, I don't know if that really was a good idea to have, like, to reintroduce her as just, like, this, like, part-time superhero, but part-time just, like, pining for the man she never had and is willing to give up everything to have him.
It's just this bullshit about this. I mean, I think this whole, like, I know you guys aren't fans of the Marvel thing, but when you compare DC to Marvel, it doesn't compare. I mean, they just don't have their shit together. They made this movie in 2017. They got Chris Pine. He was very charming and good, and I thought, in that movie, and they had great chemistry, and they can't figure out a way to not bring him back in the sequel. That's why he's there. I mean, it's not because there's some, like, storyline that he needs to come back. And honestly, like, Marvel wouldn't do that. They wanted to make the most desirable movie they could. They couldn't think of a way to get out of Chris Pine not being in these movies, and they had to bring him back. And so. I think what's funny about, and what I'd love to hear your guys' opinion on, as kind of as people who, you know, don't really like these movies and don't pay attention to the details of them, is that, you know, this character has jumped around in both her own timeline and in a cinematic timeline in this way that, like, you really have no sense of who the character is. I mean, she was in, you know, she was in World War One, and then presumably no one has paid attention to her until 1984. But then we know she helped save the world in Superman versus Batman, and then also in Justice League. Like, who is this person?
There's no big picture view. There's no...
Right.
And, like, some credit has to go to Kevin Feige for that with the Marvel movies, right? Like, they had the idea to just basically have one person kind of in charge of making sure the vision connected. And, like, here, this feels very much like, oh, the first one was successful, so let's make a sequel. Right. They're like, oh shit, we killed the leading man. Well, what do we? Oh, we'll get him. We'll figure it out. I don't know why this came to mind, but have you guys seen what's the heist movie with 50 Cent?
Den of Thieves.
Den of Thieves. So doesn't 50 Cent die in it? I think he does.
I don't know.
I think he does, but he's in the sequel that they're developing.
Oh, really?
So
you really need 50 Cent.
It's the same thing. Like, it's successful, there's a following, and they're like, oh, well, let's just make another one. Instead of having this big picture view like the Marvel movies do.
I think that's a mistake, because say what you will about Gal Gadot as an actress, say what you will about Sally Jenkins. What's her name?
Patty Jenkins
as a director. They created a really great character. I think
Gal Gadot is a good Wonder Woman. I don't know how good of an actor she is, but
I think she's a great Wonder Woman. I love that character they created. I don't know that they did her justice in this film, but you did a great job.
She doesn't talk very much, which might be good.
As an origin story, that first movie was great. It wasn't a great movie, but they established her, and that's what I was excited about. You've done this, and I feel like with Patty Jenkins, she had this power. But then I feel like they just made this movie as, like, conventional as possible. And
also, what was the purpose of the opening scene of this movie?
No idea. You could have cut 20 minutes out of it.
So the opening of it is
to not
Diana,
cheat, I guess,
at the beginning of, or as a child, running in this, or racing, like, the other heroes in her country or whatever.
The Mascara.
And Mascara. And, like, she's about to win, but she took a shortcut, so Robin Wright stops her. but it had nothing to do with the movie, which I'm only realizing now because I forgot that that first part was in the movie. And this is a 2.5 hour movie, and that was 20 minutes. Like, it's a very manageable running time if you get rid of that.
So I'm looking at Patty Jenkins' filmography here. And is she a good director, though? I mean, the one thing people sort of would give her credit for is Monster, which I don't remember enough to say, yeah, that was a well-directed movie. But other than that, honestly, the best thing on her resume is one episode of Arrested Development.
Well, I think that's what Chapin was saying. Like, she kind of did a movie that was successful critically and then kind of went away and then...
In 2003.
Right, but then she got her hands on... you know, this movie and, you know, got a lot of power as a director from it. It's just, you know, this is what she's going to be now. I mean, it's interesting but that she got that gig. I mean, I guess Hollywood looked around and they realized they had, you know, 5 female directors. So they're like,
to give her the benefit of the doubt, maybe like Warner's and the DC conglomerate machine overmanaged her and turned her off to working for them, and maybe that's why she decided to go to Disney. I don't know. I mean, it's sad. I think they could have. I was looking forward to them making a really good movie, and I don't think that's what this is. But they both got, you know, $10 million to go along with the HBO Max thing, so there's that.
Yeah, so not a total loss for them. And yeah. Then Wonder Woman learns how to fly at the end of this movie, and they use the Adagio in D minor from Sunshine, which was the most egregious sin of this movie committed.
So is it safe to say we'll be talking about this again at the Fixies?
Sure will.
Whatever our version of the Razzies are.
Pedro Pascal. So will we have their best Trump impression, Pedro Pascal or Gene Reno from Defy Bloods?
Right.
Okay.
That's going to do it for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Stay tuned. You know, this is Fixie season. Maybe we'll put out more than one podcast a week. We've been doing great, guys. Good job keeping up. I know we're going to watch the movies over the weekend, so hopefully that'll be fun. And take care. Another short episode. Brilliant.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.